If you woke up tomorrow in a world that fully celebrated and encouraged your pleasure, your joy, and your desire without limits or expectations, where no matter what your body did or wanted, you would be honored and seen as endlessly worthy and lovable without changing a single thing, what would you want? What would you crave? What would you delight in unabashedly? What happens when you see pleasure as your birthright? What happens when you see pleasure as the potential catalyst for liberation, freedom, and changing the world? If you want to ask big questions about your pleasure and untell the stories that you were given about how much you deserve and how much you have to work to earn it, my pleasure course kicks off in several weeks. And if you want to be on the notification list to hear about when enrollment opens, it's going to be an online course, multi-week, live. We're going to do online community calls, and you'll receive daily prompts that help you really change your relationship with pleasure. You can go to dawnsarah.com/pleasure course, all one word. Folks who sign up for the pre-notification will also get bonus content if they decide to join the course. It's going to be so much fun and such an invitation into your pleasure, your desire, and your joy. God, I can't wait. And I hope to see you there. So if you're interested to hear when enrollment opens, all you have to do is go to dawnsarah.com/pleasure course. You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Welcome to this week's show, everybody. Oh, it's going to be so great. I've got several listener emails that I'm going to read first, and then we are going to switch over to a delicious, exciting interview that I had with Monica Ray Simpson. Monica is someone that I have admired for so many years, and getting a chance to interview her was a dream come true. I have seen her speak at Woodhull so many times, and every time she speaks, holy shit, the ground moves, the world opens up. It is fantastic. She is someone who really has clear vision about how she's changing the world and making it a better place, why sex is so important, and access to sex education and queer spaces. Oh my God, it's just endlessly rewarding. So she works with Sister Song, which is a reproductive justice organization that I adore. They put on the Let's Talk About Sex conference that I attended last year. So it's going to be a super fun chat. So listener questions first, and then my interview with the incredible Monica Ray Simpson. So let me tell you just a little bit about Monica, and then we'll jump into the episode. Also, quick reminder, if you support the show on Patreon at $3 and above every month, you get weekly bonus content, which works out to like 80 cents a week or something like that. And if you support at $5 and above per month, you can help me field listener questions. So as listener questions come in, I post them in Patreon, and then you have an opportunity to play Sexpert and to offer your opinions and your stories, and then I might read them on the show, which happens today with a listener question that I got. So Monica Ray Simpson, a queer, Black, North Carolina native, has organized extensively against human rights abuse, the prison industry, racism, and systemic violence against Southern Black women and LGBTQ people. A proud graduate of the historically black Johnson C. Smith University, she earned a bachelor's in communications and organized for LGBTQ rights on and off campus. She then became the operations director and the first person of color at the Charlotte Lesbian and Gay Community Center. Next, she trained black youth in activism, philanthropy, and fundraising as the Ijuma Coordinator for Grassroots Leadership. In 2010, she moved to Georgia to be Sister Song's Development Coordinator, and in 2013, she was named Executive Director of Sister Song. Her bio is extensive and goes so much deeper than that, so if you want to read the whole thing, head to sexgetsreal.com/EP229 for episode 229, because Monica is fucking impressive. So anyway, here is the listener questions, followed by my, oh God, heart-opening, so excited interview with Monica all about the erotic and pleasure and reproductive justice. The first listener email for today is from D. Lowe with a subject line of "Something Dawned on Me," episode 224. Hey, Dawn. First, I love your podcast. Thank you, beautiful woman. Secondly, I was listening to episode 224 last week, and you spoke about Hannah Gadsby's Nanette and the impact it had in you and your partner. Me and mine had a similar experience. What resonated with me was when she spoke of her homophobia of herself and the self-loathing that she endured as a result. Later in the show, you spoke about fat bodies and the self-judgment that went along with that for you, and I had a revelation. Similarly, but nowhere near on the same scale of ferociousness of Hannah, I'm defs not comparing my experience to hers, I experienced a kind of self-loathing due to being in a bigger body and society, friends, family, media, etc., telling me all my life that fat is bad and skinny is good. I grew up hating my shape, my curves, my size. I was always comparing and conscious of the space I took up, even noting to myself when I was the biggest in the room. Crazy, huh? I just wanted to say, not anymore. My body does everything I ask of it and more, and I refuse to hate it. Thank you for being a catalyst for my thought and perceptions of aspects of my life. Love, D-Lo. That felt wonderful to receive, D-Lo. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sure so many people that are listening feel similarly. I know that has been the journey that I have been on, and it is complex and rich and rewarding and confusing and all of the things, but you're so right. There are so many aspects of ourselves depending on how our bodies are in the world, right? Whether we have fat bodies or black bodies or disabled bodies or maybe even genitals that look different than we thought they should based on what we see in porn or what our friends have. There's just so much around us that encourages us to compare and to judge and to try and control ourselves. And so I love that you are now in a place where you can say not anymore. And that you know that your body does everything you ask for it, of it, and more. That is the key. When we can be in our bodies and just realize our bodies are always doing its best. Like, that blew my mind the first time I heard somebody tell me that. Like, your body literally is always doing its best with what you give it. Always. Your body never is like, nah, I'm taking the day off today. It's doing the very best it can. And sometimes that best is disappointing because we're comparing ourselves to others or to who our body used to be, you know, years ago. But our body shows up every day and does the best that it can. And we're awfully cruel to our bodies, considering how tirelessly they work on our behalf. So I love that you're finding that spaciousness and that compassion. And yeah, Hannah Gadsby's Nanette is so important and so phenomenal. And what an incredible way to use a stage and a platform. And holy smokes, I have a big crush on Hannah Gadsby. So thank you so much for listening to the show, D-Lo, and for writing in. I really appreciate it. This next email comes from Julie with a subject line of "Mindfulness Caveats." Hi, Dawn. I really appreciated the episode with Dr. Brado. I agree that mindfulness is an amazing tool for many things. I just thought it was important to point out that there are some people that need to be careful when attempting this practice, especially if they are trying it without the direct guidance of a therapist. If you're a person who experiences extreme anxiety or panic attacks or has PTSD, many mindfulness exercises can trigger panic attacks. It's especially likely during exercises focusing on breathing or body scanning. The other group that should be very careful are those with chronic pain, again, because mindfulness heightens the awareness of sensation. I'm not saying mindfulness exercises aren't helpful for those groups. In fact, they can be extremely helpful. I'm only saying that mindfulness is primarily used to combat dissociation and to bring someone back into the moment. If you're someone with those conditions, dissociation is often a protective instinct, and it can be very scary to try to practice mindfulness without a trained therapist there to lead you in how to avoid pain or panic that can result when you let go of the distance between your mind and body. Love the show. Keep up the great work making the world a sexier place. Thank you so much for writing in with this, Julie. I totally agree. I just started reading Jon Kabat-Zinn's Full Catastrophe Living on Dr. Lori Brado inspired me to really learn about a lot of the studies that they've been doing for so many years with cancer patients and patients who have chronic pain and all kinds of persistent experiences and health conditions. But I will say, as someone who has pretty intense anxiety, focusing on my breathing is one of the fastest ways for me to induce panic attacks. It really depends on the day, and it really depends on what's going on in my body. I am hypervigilant about my body. So one of the things that really, really is a guaranteed trigger for anxiety is noticing my breathing and also hearing my heartbeat. If I hear my heartbeat, I immediately start panicking and wondering all kinds of things about, am I going to hear another beat? Is this the right rhythm? All kinds of stuff. And so I have all kinds of wonderful coping mechanisms that I use that help me to manage those things. And there are certainly times and places where breathing and slowing down and listening to my breath and noticing my chest feels so luscious and good. For people who are new to their anxiety or panic disorders, or for people who don't have a lot of really practiced coping techniques, I 100% agree that might induce more panic. So working with professionals who, like Dr. Lori Brado and her team, and Jon Kabat-Zinn, and you know all the folks that are doing incredible things helping people through cancer, definitely seek out someone who can support you and who can help you feel held and safe and seen as you start practicing this, if you notice that it does cause tension or fear. So thank you for writing in with that and offering it to people who might find that mindfulness exercises trigger things inside of themselves. So mindfulness can help so much around PTSD and panic and anxiety, but you're right. Doing it with someone who can guide you and support you and offer other types of safety measures as you kind of tiptoe into those things is a very wise and important thing. So thank you so much for listening to the show and for writing in with this very thoughtful little asterisk. I couldn't agree more based on my experience. And I hope everyone out there, whether it's on your own or with a trained professional, after hearing Dr. Brado, decides to dabble with a little bit of mindfulness. Who knows? All kinds of yummy things might happen, especially when you're like touching other people. I have found that mindfulness for me, since being in my body sometimes is a little bit tough, that doing mindfulness where I am engaging with others or when I'm doing like a walking meditation is a much easier way for me to gain entry to my body. So if my hands are feeling someone else's hair and skin and, you know, the ridges and the valleys of their body, it's much easier for me to drop in and get really present. So experiment and try different things and trust yourself, trust your body. So yeah, thank you so much for writing in, Julie. Last email before we get to the incredible Monica Ray Simpson. It was a dream to get to interview her, so I can't wait for you to hear it, but we'll field this question first. I got a fantastic response from a Patreon supporter. So for those of you who don't know, you can support the show at patreon.com/sexgetsreal. If you support at $3 and above every month, you get weekly bonus content. And if you support it $5 a month and above, you get to help me field listener questions. And then for some of those answers, I read them on air. And one of those was super thoughtful, and I will be reading it today. So I got an anonymous email that says, "Hi, Dawn. I wrote in a few months back about fear of sex and pain during intercourse, and your answers were so helpful and eloquent. Now I'm back with question number two. An entirely new topic. Woohoo! I've been seeing a new lover and we've had sex twice, but neither time he got off. The first time we had been drinking, so he was unable to stay hard, which I totally get. It was also new and a little awkward, but we laughed it off and it was fine. The second time he stayed hard for hours, literally. He somewhat warmed me that he could last a long time, but I didn't realize how long. Finally, he told me he had to pee really bad and got up to go to the bathroom. I feel a little disappointed because the sex is really good in my opinion, and we fit well together and are very comfortable and compatible with one another. I feel like I'm not enough or I'm not doing enough, even though he seems to be enjoying it. Part of me wonders if he's just nervous or anxious. Maybe things will get better. Is there something I can do? In the past, men have come without me even really needing to touch them. I used to be a stripper, so I can give a good lap dance and turn men on pretty easily. This is making me second guess myself, and I'm sure he also feels like he's not performing as he should. What's the best way to go about this? All the best, XOXO, Anonymous." So I posed this question anonymously in Patreon, and someone named Crystal Force offered a very detailed answer. And so I'm going to share what Crystal had to say and then see what I have to add afterwards, because it's pretty thorough. So Crystal wrote, "First and foremost, sex does not require orgasm or ejaculation to be enjoyable. Fact. Most of us struggle with that thought at first. The expectation of quote unquote needing to orgasm is a very strong anxiety inducer, which tends to tense the body and not allow for orgasm to be reached. Instead, making it about the sensuality and pleasure is a better way to place expectations. Secondly, the partner of those with penises with this sexual concern tend to put the continuous blame, in quotes, on our own shoulders. Did we do something wrong? Is it that they just aren't attracted enough to us? What else can I do to make it better for them? The reality is that in almost all cases, it's not the partner's actions. And finally, the harder question, does he have a medical, emotional, psychological, or a social concern that is the real cause of this? He has obviously had this situation for a long time, and he may not even realize that he could have a medical condition called retrograde ejaculation. Or he could have other physiological issues that should be addressed if he is distressed over it. Emotionally, if he's anxious, it makes it much more difficult to achieve orgasm. He may be struggling with performance anxiety and that he knows you're expecting him to ejaculate, and he also knows that he struggles to achieve it. Add in that this is a new relationship and he has a lot to be anxious over, possibly. Psychologically, he could be struggling with being a victim of abuse or depression. He may have even brought up in a strict conservative household where sex is considered shameful and bad. Even though he's older now and may think differently, those lessons are fairly firmly ingrained and for some need intense work to fully resolve. Socially as well, being able to quote unquote last a long time is considered the mark of a quote unquote true stud. This societal misperception does so much more harm than good. I would advise that maybe you could suggest that instead of sex with the expectation of orgasm, to instead find other forms of intimacy, such as sensual massage, allowing him to be able to enjoy intimate touch, where there's no expectation or the need to orgasm. Alternatively, you could try giving him space, that if he can orgasm with masturbation but struggles with sex, to make it part of your sexual activities. Some men may have done a disservice to themselves, training their body to need a very specific form of stimulation to achieve orgasm, from a very firm and tight grip during masturbation. That is, in many cases, not reproducible with partner penetration. Ultimately, if he's distressed or concerned about this, he should see his doctor or a specialist called a urologist to ensure that there are no physiological or medical issues in play. Then he can seek out a sex coach if he wishes to obtain more information to help him work through and unpack what might be the cause of his situation. My recommendation for you is to remain supportive and to take the pressure off of him by not expecting ejaculation as the ultimate pinnacle to be achieved in sex. There's so much more fun and pleasure that can be had when in comparison to that few seconds that you get from an orgasm, which is over too fast for most. As they say, it's not the end point, but the journey along the way. So thank you so much, Crystal Force, for sharing your thoughts. So a couple of my thoughts. Anonymous, in your email, it didn't seem like anything you shared was distressing to him. More just that he was aware and said, I can last a really long time. And then you're struggling with, is it me? And Crystal did kind of mention that often when partners of people with penises notice that something isn't kind of playing to the script in our head, that we tend to internalize it as something we've done. We're not attractive enough. We're not skilled enough. We're doing something wrong. He must have feelings about us, or they must have feelings about us, since all kinds of genders can have penises. And I'm really glad that Crystal named that, because that's what I'm hearing here. You've had sex a couple of times, and that is, first of all, not enough to really determine a pattern. There are so many things that could be at play, both the first time you had sex and the second time that you had sex. I would say if you have multiple instances of something where this is happening, then maybe that's the pattern. This might be an outlier. Also, I think Crystal brings up some great points. If he is distressed about this, if he is ashamed or worried, there are all kinds of things that he can do to, you know, just inquire within. I mean, there doesn't have to be anything wrong with him. Maybe he's just has really long staying power. I had a partner years ago who, even after ejaculation and orgasm, pretty much stayed hard and could just kind of keep going. That was just how his body was. He was also very young, and who knows how his body was going to change over the years and the decades. So if he's not distressed about this, and this is just about you, I think the question just gets to become, maybe this is just his body, and how can you work with that and make that fun? We get so many cultural messages about how we're responsible for so many things that our partners are experiencing. And sometimes that's from a place of generosity. We want our partners to have a good time. We want our partners to feel pleasure. We want to ensure that they're like really, truly there with us and we're creating something together. And then sometimes that is actually more tied to anxiety and a fear of lack or a fear of being abandoned in, if I don't perform, if I don't live up to the expectation, they'll leave. I'll lose access to this thing that I'm really enjoying. I'll lose access to this pleasure that feels really good. So just kind of settle in with yourself and ask, you know, like, am I really feeling distressed about this? Or is this just new and it kind of surprised me a little bit? And also, the one thing that I didn't notice in your email was, have you talked to him about this? You know, have you asked him, what's your experience of your body? What's your experience with your penis? What is it like for you when you've got a hard cock and it lasts for a really long time? Is that something you enjoy? Is that something that's just kind of neutral? What has your experience been with past partners around this? And just kind of start a dialogue. Get really curious. You can't ever know what his experience is if you don't directly ask him. So maybe for him, he enjoys the fact that his body can do this, or maybe it's a totally neutral thing and he's had a mixture of experiences. And so he was just letting you know because of that. Maybe he's concerned that you're going to feel like you're not living up to expectations because he's had that before and he can offer you reassurance. So I would start with self-inquiry and just kind of checking in with, am I asking these questions because I feel like I should? Am I asking these questions because I really do feel like I've done something bad or because I'm not living up to his expectations based on something, some hint he gave me? And then ask him, get super curious about all of his experiences and see where that leads. I'll bet that being able to ask him about his body and his history and where he'd like to be and how he experiences pleasure and just like generously opening with curiosity to his story is going to build so much more connection than trying to silently find a way to perform in a way that meets an expectation that you've told yourself about him and his body. So good luck to you, Anonymous. Thank you so much for writing in. I'm so glad that that first question you asked, my answer was helpful. I hope that this just gives you some things to think about too. And thank you so much to Crystal Force for not only supporting the show, but also for offering such a thoughtful answer that you, Anonymous, can now take to your partner if you want to have that conversation. And if he does experience or express any kind of distress, there's all kinds of things now that Crystal has provided for you to think through. So it is now time for my interview with Monica Rae Simpson. Here we go. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Monica. To say that I am thrilled and over the moon to talk to you today is an understatement. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I am super pumped to be on, and I feel like I'm just as equally excited. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome. So listeners know what a fan I am of your work and of Sister Song's work. And of course, I've been to Woodhull many, many years and rave about it whenever I go. So I know the listeners will be excited as well about our chat. So I would love to start. You do such incredible, important work around reproductive justice and sexuality and sexual freedom. And for people who aren't familiar with what reproductive justice means, could you give us a little bit of a primer?
Sure. So I'll have to take it back to 1994, really, when I let people know about reproductive justice, because a lot of folks just think that, you know, it's something that has come into our social justice movement spaces, you know, over the past couple of years. And that's actually not true. This framework has been one that is well over two decades old. And so in 1994, a group of Black women came together in Chicago, Illinois. And one of the folks that was in the room is our founding national coordinator, Loretta Ross, as well as amazing folks like Tony Bond Leonard and other like really fantastic, hella dope Black women whose analysis that we just keep, you know, grabbing onto today. They were in this room together because it was at the height of healthcare reform in this country under the Clinton administration. And these conversations around what does healthcare reform mean for our communities, the most marginalized communities? What does it mean for us? How do we want to be active in this conversation? What's necessary for us to center in this conversation? All these questions they were wrestling with. And so they decided to put their voices forward to Congress and say that if we're going to have a conversation about healthcare reform in this country, that you're going to listen to Black women, you're going to listen to people of color, you're going to center our issues, and you're not going to exclude reproductive healthcare from this conversation on healthcare, because it is a part of our healthcare, right? And in particular, they did not want the conversation around abortion, right? In particular, to be excluded from the conversation on healthcare reform. And so they put their thoughts out there. They put their demands out there in this direct action that they did. They wrote this call to action to Congress and put that in the Washington Post and had like hundreds and hundreds of signatures. I think it was almost 800 signatures of folks from all across the country who were standing in solidarity with this statement these Black women created. And they were calling themselves women of African descent for reproductive justice. And this term reproductive justice was birthed, looking at reproductive health and rights in connection with social justice issues. And so that's where we see the birth of the term, right, was in that conversation and in that action that Black women created in 1994. And when Sister Song came to be in 1997, you know, as this national collective of Indigenous women and women of color, we were able to kind of rebirth that term and to really use that framework in our efforts to really advance reproductive health and rights in this country and to take a more intersectional approach to really ground and root our work in the human rights framework. And it was a pretty transformative thing, right? This frame was very transformative because it really pushed us away from the single issue kind of lens that a lot of folks were kind of organizing with in terms of like reproductive health and rights at the time. And Yeah, so now we have this framework now movement, right? Called reproductive justice that, you know, if we were to define that, you know, Sister Song talks about reproductive justice and defines it as, you know, our human right, you know, to have children in the ways that we want, whether that's, you know, all the things that we need around birth justice, maternal health care, doulas, midwives, really bringing in our cultural practices and thinking about what's important for us in having the children that we want and having access to the health care that we need for that. We also have the human right to not have children and to prevent or end pregnancies with dignity, without shame, and safely and legally, right? And so this is where we get our work around, you know, access to contraception, our abortion rights and access work really falls very squarely under that particular tenet. We also define it as a human right to parent the children that we already have with healthy, in healthy and safe environments and without fear, right, of like the government or police or polluted water, right? Like, we really think about, like, what does it take to really raise our families and raise our children in environments that allow them to grow to their fullest potential. And ultimately, you know, we kind of added this last piece of our work, which really helps us hold, like, our sexual freedom work. It helps to hold, you know, the growing work around queering of RJ and thinking about how queer and trans folks are deeply connected to this work. And it's our human right to bodily autonomy, free from all forms of reproductive oppression, which we really talk about as like the control and exploitation and violation of our bodies, our sexuality, our labor, right? So we say really simply that the reproductive justice is our human right to have a child, to not have a child, and to parent the children we have in healthy and safe environments, and our human right to bodily autonomy.
Holy shit. There's so much power in what you're sharing, and it's also something that clearly you've talked a lot about because packed so much in so thoughtfully and clearly. It was beautiful, and like I basically just want to like shake my pom-poms.
I love pom-poms as an ex-cheerleader. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So I first had an opportunity to hear you speak at a round table at Woodhull several years ago. And I know that, you know, so much of the way that you've partnered with Woodhull is around that sexual freedom piece. Mm-hmm. And then Sister Song has their own conference, which I raved about last year, the Let's Talk About Sex conference. I had an amazing time doing a workshop there, and it was so healing and nurturing and beautiful. So can you tell us a little bit about when you think about all the things you work on? I mean, from like prison reform and thinking about clean water and healthcare to abortion and queer and trans issues, why Let's Talk About Sex?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting when we think about, you know, reproductive health and rights and justice work, you know, in general, right? We are talking a lot about the access that we need around contraceptions, or we talk about our ability to have access to safe and legal abortions. We talk about parenting and maternal health and, you know, what food people need to have healthy bodies, to have healthy babies and to have healthy children. You know, all these conversations kind of get wrapped up in that. But the thing that's like the through line, right, when we think about having children or not, or, you know, making sure that we have what we need for the children that we do have, sex is just kind of like the thing that runs through that, right? Like, children don't get here without sex. Like, we, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's, well, actually they do. Let's just be clear about that. But, you know, this conversation around sex and bodies and sexuality and sexualities, as we also like to talk about in the Sister Song, like, that is the through line, right? To all of the work that we do. It's really about body, right? Our bodies. And our decision-making around our bodies, our decision-making around our futures. And so what Sister Song, because I wasn't a part of Sister Song whenever they decided to start the Let's Talk About Sex conference in 2007, what the leadership at that time realized was that we're in these conversations all the time about everything that's impacting our body, but we don't have a space to talk about our bodies. We don't have a space as people of color in particular, because that was really the goal of Let's Talk About Sex, was to create this, the safest place possible for people of color to really be able, and Indigenous folks, to be able to talk about sex and bodies in a space that, you know, was ours, right? Curated and created by us, right? For us to like really be able to connect and move our work around these issues. And those spaces weren't really available for us. And so Sister Song created a space that was so incredibly needed for us, by us, right? So yeah, that's why the conference is so necessary and was very, we were very explicit in the name. We didn't want it to get confused. We want anyone confused, right? We are here to talk about sex and all the things that's connected to that, whether that's our reproductive health, our reproductive rights, our ability to make decisions about our bodies. What do we need? You know, how do we enjoy pleasure? What does pleasure mean for us? All those conversations that get so locked up in those kind of secret places in our communities. We were creating a place for us to have those conversations out loud with each other and to connect with other people who wanted to have those conversations and learn and grow and build with each other. So that's really what Let's Talk About Sex is about. It has now become like the premier reproductive justice conference, right? There's not really another national repro conference that allows us to have these conversations and to create these spaces that we do at Let's Talk About Sex. And for that to be led by folks of color is pretty amazing, right? And I think that that's what, makes the space feel so transformative and so different from any conference that you'll ever experience. That's our goal with each Let's Talk About Sex, is for folks to have a transformative experience, right, with this work. And so hopefully we're doing that. But we're excited that we're going to have our next conference, our next Let's Talk About Sex conference in October of 2019. So we are like, it's happening again. People, we've been, every time I go to speak somewhere, I have a chance to like connect with folks on the ground. They're like, when is it happening? When is it happening? They want us to have, they want it to happen every year. But we do have it every other year for now. And we're excited that 2019 is the next year in October.
I will do everything I can to be there because last year's was magic. And exactly what you said, transformative. You know, like really, truly transformative. And I will rave about this for the next 14 months to get everybody there. So. So you mentioned really having a space to kind of talk about our bodies and pleasure, especially for people who are POC, Indigenous, queer, trans, people that are at the most marginalized intersections. And I'm wondering, like, you know, we've talked on the show a number of times about the ways that pleasure can be radical and liberatory. And I'd love to know, like, for you personally, what does pleasure really mean for you?
I love that question. Thank you. In these days and times where we're always talking about trauma and oppression, it feels good just to take a breath and exhale to think about pleasure, right? Just for a moment. So thank you for the question. but for me, pleasure is that exhale, right? Like, I mean, it's the ability to be free of the oppression, for our trauma not to be what leads us or what moves us towards action. Pleasure is that energy that that helps me be creative. It helps me to be generative and to think outside of the box, to think of solutions. Yeah, it's that very liberatory space for me energetically. For me, it's not just connected to like what feeling I get from someone else or what feeling I get because, you know, I'm having some, you know, amazing sexual experience. But pleasure is bigger than that for me, right? And it is more about that energy, that vibration that moves through all of my chakras, that moves through my entire being, that allows me to disconnect from the oppression and the trauma and to really have a moment as long as I can make it last, right? Where I actually feel liberation in my body.
Oh, yeah. I've really been grappling with how can pleasure serve to not only like heal and connect me to myself, but also heal and help me connect to the collective.
Yes.
And that's such a big, beautiful and exciting question of kind of like looking towards the things that we want. And so I adore what you just said around like it not only moving through your entire being, but being able to lead from a place that's like creative and generative rather than leading from our trauma and pain. Oh, yeah, we need more of that.
For sure.
So you just presented with several other folks on the power of the erotic at this year's Woodhole. And it was the first Woodhole I haven't been at in many years. I was at a fat activism conference that was fantastic. But it hurt my heart to not be there. So seeing the tweets come out was magic. And the erotic is something that I'm so fascinated by, because I think we kind of have these mainstream, heterocentric, cis kind of pop culture definitions of the erotic. And then there's the like Black feminist Audre Lorde version of the erotic. And could you tell us a little bit about how you talk about the erotic and what the erotic means for you and kind of the ways that you are presenting it at the conference?
Yeah. So let me tell you, I had such an awesome time with this work at the Woodhole Conference. You know, we have been, you know, a partner and working with Woodhole for many years for their conference. And, you know, I'm really grateful for the consistent space that Woodhole provides, you know, for activists and folks to really talk about these issues, to find the connections, to build on the work, to have a lot of fun. You know, it's really purposeful and like so necessary in these times. And, you know, I was first introduced to Audre Lorde's Power of the Erotic whenever I was an undergrad. I grew up in this very small rural town in North Carolina. And so I talk a lot in my reproductive justice story, as we call it, at Sister Song, about, you know, how difficult it was for us to find access, or how difficult it was for me to find access to reflections of other types of people, right? Like, it was just, if it wasn't on television, it was very hard for me to find it anywhere, right? When you live in rural America. And I remember going to, you know, my library on campus, and I had heard through some other friends of mine, because I had just came out on campus. And so this name Audre Lorde started floating around in my universe. And I said, well, let me just sit with Audre Lorde for a minute, right? Let's see what it's about. And she forever changed my life, right? You know, her words, her work, you know, the way that I was able to see myself in a way that I had just never been able to see myself was completely transformative for me. And yeah, I'm so grateful for that introduction and just like those first days of being connected to Audre Lorde's work. And I remember coming across this small essay, right? The Power of the Erotic, the Uses of the Erotic. And I was like, ooh, erotic. And so I was ready to get all up in that, because I was all about my sexual erotic energy back then. But for me, it was about sex. It was about like feeling like, who am I having this feeling with? And Audre Lorde took me in a completely different direction with her words. Mm-hmm. And she started to talk about it from a very personal perspective about how do we connect to that energy within us that helps us create and to lead. And it wasn't connected to somebody else. Yeah, up until that point, the erotic for me had to be connected to somebody else. Like, my erotic self had to be because I was trying to show someone or prove to someone or, you know, woo someone, right? Like, that's what erotic meant to me. And she completely changed that definition for me. She's like, it's not about anybody else, really. It's about like, who are you? She took me on this journey to get more connected to myself, who I was. And so I thought that this would have been a really great way to start to talk about erotic power and eroticism from a different perspective at Woodhole this year, especially because of where we are politically, right? And just, you know, what we're having to face and all the different movements and work that we do, where everything outside of us is just so oppressive, right? And so if we're going to talk about sexual freedom, how do we talk about it from a perspective that allows us to go deep within, to think about what are those things that we have within us that will push us further in our leadership, that pushes us further in our idea creations and our ability to think about solutions. And so the way that she broke down in her writing about the difference between like the pornographic, which we had some grappling with in the room, right? Because this was not about shaming pornography, right? But she was helping us understand this definition from a pornographic about, you know, this denial of the erotic power and how it really emphasizes sensation without feeling. And we allowed folks in the room to really grapple with that.
Yeah.
And then we put that against like this definition of the erotic that she gave us, which looked at like this internal sense of power, and how we have a sense of self and how we think about what that means in terms of our own power. And then like the larger conversation of power. And it was just so fascinating to see the participants in the room just take their time with like going through what these words meant from them and to really think about these words through the lens of Black feminism, mm-hmm. right? Which I also think was really, really exciting for folks in the room. So yeah, it took people, I think that people came again, just like I came to the text. This was a new text for a lot of folks in the room of like, oh, I get to think about how sexy I'm about to be. And this was like, actually, you are here because it's time for you to go deeper within yourself. And what does that mean to do that work? Because we need that level of like introspection and that level of like, you know, I keep using the word transformative a lot today, but it's just like, that's the kind of like internal work that we need right now, because we need our folks, like all of us, to be able to stand fully in our power. And what does it look like if we led from that place, right? And I think that's what Audre Lorde was helping us to see in her writing. And I think that that's what we were able to help folks in the room understand.
What comes up for me as you ask that question of like, what does it mean for all of us to stand fully in our power? Because we need that. It kind of gives me this, I don't know, this really like deep, grounded, rooted feeling of like, if all of us could really find that power and understand ourselves and heal the things that we need to heal and grieve the things we need to grieve, and then just like show up in that kind of like messiness that is ourselves, but to really know it and to stand beside folks who are doing the same, even if we are talking about sex, to enter into a sexual encounter from that place of power with someone else who's in that place of power is radically different than entering into sex as kind of this like consumer performance that we see a lot in like pop culture and media these days.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And we use a lot of pop culture references in our work in our training, to help people see that. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And we used images. We use like, music videos. We use movies themselves. Right. And like video movies and different things like that to help people see that. Right. Because, you know, what we get and what society gives us, right, is just like this definition that Audre Lorde gives us in her writing as the pornographic, like it's just about a sensation. It's about a feeling. Like that's what we're chasing, is the feeling, right? And what she's pushing us to and what she's charging us to, what I get from this is like, what if we were chasing ourselves? Like, you know, like what if we, like if that's what we were chasing, like not someone else or something outside of us, what if we were really putting that energy into ourselves? And like you said, if we were connecting with each other, whether it's intimately, physically, creatively, you know, organizationally, whatever, right? Like if we were coming to each other from those places, like the power that we would have, and we talked about this at the end of our session, like what would it look like to use the power of the erratic to dismantle systems of oppression? What does it look like to use this power that we all have to really eradicate, you know, and dismantle the system of white supremacy, right? And yeah, the conversation that we were able to get from that was so rich because people weren't really thinking about it from that place, right? They were like, oh, like we can, that would be really interesting and different. And it would be a strategy and tactic that I feel like our oppressors have been, you know, really trying to push us away from, right? Like they try to keep us in this, you know, just chasing the feeling, wanting to get the sensation kind of world, mm-hmm. where if we were to flip that dynamic, it would actually flip everything. I truly believe that. I think that Audre Lorde was prophetic in some ways, right? Around like, if we were to take on this understanding and like really move from this place, oppression would have a harder time of grabbing us and taking hold and keeping hold of us, right? I truly believe that.
Yeah, because I think so much of the job of oppression is to keep us distracted and mm-hmm. searching for answers outside of ourselves.
Exactly. Exactly. And she's just like, we already have it, right? It's in us. And how about we start to access that, right? And then like, yeah, move forward. And I was really excited to revisit this text, you know, now 20 years later, I think it is. I'm really dating myself, but I was just home in my hometown for my 20th high school reunion, which was very interesting. So it's just making me really think about the dating of myself. But, and I was thinking about who I was then versus who I am now, which is, that's a whole other like podcast that we can do with each other. But
yeah,
you know, revisiting that with who I am now in this movement work, doing this reproductive justice work, I feel like this is such a powerful solution for us. It's a powerful possibility for us, you know, and thinking about the ways in which we connect again, intimately, creatively, organizationally, in just a completely different way. And I would be so excited to think about what came out of, what would come out of that, right? And what would be possible for us. And that's kind of how we ended our session at Woodhull, was like, let's hold the possibilities of what is possible when we actually use our erotic power from this place that Audre Lorde really kind of teaches us about, right? And I think people left so excited, right? And so they left like with such anticipation about like what is possible. And isn't that what we want? Like, that's the kind of energy I want to live in, like that anticipation. Like, I think about like what comes about in foreplay, you know, like that was about to happen. Maybe it will happen. Maybe it won't. I don't know. But like that anticipatory kind of like energy, it makes us like ready for anything, right? And I think that that's what folks were really looking for. Again, especially with so much that we're having to hold and deal with in the work that we do every day, this gives us that, it gives us that different energy to move with. It made me super excited. And it was great to see that the folks in the room were also really receptive of that. So I was just like, oh, we got to do more of this. We have to have more of these conversations. Because I see the impact that it had in even just a one day training, right, with folks in the room.
So my next question for you is not a small one, but thinking about all of these conversations and the years that you've had to really grapple with the power of the erotic and reproductive justice and sexual freedom, like for you personally, when you imagine a post-oppressive world, what would sexual liberation look like for you?
You have some really good questions today.
Thank you.
And I'm super appreciative. What would sexual freedom look like for me? Well, for me, it would look like the little Black girl growing up in a rural town, not feeling like she had to hide her like, you know, inquisitive kind of spirit, you know? I grew up with I had so many questions. I wanted to experience so much and feel so much and touch so much. And like, I was just so connected to like my body and feeling and things. And I didn't feel like I had an outlet for that anywhere. Like, I felt like I had to keep that so hidden within myself. So I couldn't ask questions. I couldn't see if there was other folks I could connect with who felt the same way. I felt like it was just me, myself, and I in this little box of like wanting to know what it felt like or what it feels like or what it would be like. And so in this post-oppressive world, that little girl that grows up in, no matter where she lives, but even if she lives like in the rural town like I did, she would not feel like she was alone, right? She would not feel like she has to hold herself or hide herself or, you know, shy away from conversations or even experiences, right? That she would have the ability to ask those questions, to be in community, to actually have community, right? To kind of figure that out for herself and not feel like she was doing that under a cloud of shame, right? in this post-oppressive world, like sexual freedom to me looks like, you know, if sexual freedom exists, then, you know, reproductive oppression does not, right? And so the control and exploitation of our bodies and the violation of our bodies, our sexuality, our labor, like that no longer exists. That means that I don't have to be that little girl who was, you know, touched improperly and way too soon and without consent, you know, way too young. Like that's not an experience I would have to grow up with, right? I could wear what I wanted to wear and not have to worry about that being an entry point for individuals thinking they can like touch and be a part, you know, mm-hmm. be with my body, right? Like it's a world where we actually get to like, not have to hold our breath whenever we're in a space where there's like, you know, where it feels like it could be dangerous. Yeah, I remember, you know, being in spaces growing up where there was a lot of guys. I remember this one time in particular, you know, we were at this party and I was with a couple of friends of mine and somehow we ended up in this room with like all these guys, you know, and this, I was still very young, probably like 16 years old at this party. And a moment happened in that room where I was like, something bad can really happen right now. And I don't know how I would get out of it, right? But that level of fear that I had, like in this post-oppressive world, that wouldn't have to exist for people, right? That wouldn't have to be the thing that, you know, that folks have to worry about, you know? That's what it looks like for me. That's what it feels like for me. I mean, those are just some of the things. I mean, there's probably so much more, right? But, you know, my little queer self, like my little country girl queer self, I ain't got to think, you know, I would have representation. I wouldn't have to wait until I was, you know, damn near 20 years old to find Audre Lorde, you know what I'm saying? To like finally see myself, right? Like I would already see myself, you know? Mm. So yeah, that's kind of how it would look and feel for me in some ways anyway.
Thank you so much for sharing. It feels really personal and also like so hopeful to imagine a world where we don't have that fear and we don't have to hold our breath and we don't have to worry about saying the wrong thing or wearing the wrong thing. And we just have access mm-hmm. to our bodies and our curiosity on our terms from the youngest of ages. Like even that alone would be revolutionary.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. I want that world, which is why I work for reproductive justice every single day, because I want that world.
Literally, you wear a cape in my eyes. I mean, like a superhero of change. So, yes. Well, I want to respect your time. I know you've got a flight to catch, and I would love to talk to you for so many more hours. But in the interest of kind of wrapping this up, how can people find you online, find out about Sister Song, and keep their eye out for the Let's Talk About Sex conference?
Absolutely. So you can always find all things Sister Song at our website, sistersong.net. Very, very easy to find all the things there. You can also keep an eye out for us on social media, especially Twitter. We try to, you know, our Twitter world is kind of lit. So please get in on that. And that's at sistersong_WOC. The same thing for Facebook, same thing for Instagram. Like we try to keep the social media on point. So please follow us and please be a part of our virtual family, because once you're part of the virtual family, then you are family. So come on over. And our Let's Talk About Sex conference, we know it's going down in 2019 in October, and we're like slowly giving you all teasers on all the things around that. So you can go to the letstalkaboutsex.com website as well. That's also directly connected to our sistersong.net website. So you can go either place. And so just keep going back. You can check out the videos and all the information that was up from last year, if you didn't get a chance to see that, just to kind of see what the experience was. And you'll be able to see all the updates as we start to roll those out starting this October. So it's going to be super fun. We're very excited about it. And there were over 1,000 people at our last conference in New Orleans in 2017. So we want to double that. So we want everybody, you know, to be there and to come experience this experience that we have known as Let's Talk About Sex. So yeah, please, please, please follow us, be with us, because we want to be with y'all.
Yay. Well, I will have all of those links in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com for this episode. So people can just click all the things and follow all the places. Monica, thank you so much for being here with me today and for sharing your wisdom and your stories with all of us. This felt so nourishing.
Thank you. It felt really, really good to be in conversation with you too. I love the program. I'm so glad that you're doing what you're doing. So yay for that. Keep it going because we need it right now.
We surely do. And to everybody who tuned in, thank you so much for being here with us. Of course, you can get all the details and send in your questions at sexgetsreal.com. So until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah with Monica Ray Simpson. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue, treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the vocal Few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
So don't be ashamed.